On the agenda is approval of the minutes from the first meeting of the redistricting committee on January 9th. Representative Anderson, like to move the minutes, Representative? So moved. Any discussion on that motion? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Next item is the approval of the minutes from the January 16th meeting, the second meeting, redistricting committee. Representative Riffenberg moves the minutes. January 16th, all in favor, any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, last week we spent a little bit of time getting some historical background on redistricting, and we'll go a little more in depth today, going through more thoroughly the legal requirements for redistricting more attentively here in Minnesota, and then hearing from Tom Pender in House Research, and then following up from Peter Watson from Senate Counsel, who will discuss a little bit in more detail what happened in the 1990s, and then as well, as I understand, talk about designing a plan that will, in fact, hold up to court scrutiny. So with that, welcome to the committee, Mr. Pender.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When Mr. Watson and I decided how to divide up our presentation today, we decided that I would give a start off with a broad overview of the laws that apply to redistricting in Minnesota. And then, as the chair said, Mr. Watson will follow up with a more in-depth discussion of particularly the federal constitutional and statutory requirements as developed by case law over the years. I'm going to use a handout here that should be in the members' folders. And I assume there are copies for the audience back there. And I'm going to be basically taking you through this handout, and I'm not using the new technology here because it just doesn't fit very well with the kind of presentation I'm giving today. And I tried here to gather together all the federal and state laws that apply, and I've included the complete text of almost all of the state laws that apply at the end of the handout here. So this is something the members might want to consider keeping in their committee folders to refer to, because these statutes are spread all over the 10 or 11 volumes or however many there are of Minnesota statutes, and this puts them all together. I'm going to go through this overview of the legal authorities that govern Minnesota redistricting law in sort of an order of hierarchy from highest authority to lowest. So I'm starting with the U.S. Constitution as interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court. And at the top of page 2 of the handout there, we have an excerpt from the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. This is the Equal Protection Clause, and was used by the U.S. Supreme Court in the mid-1960s to establish the one person, one vote, or they called it one man, one vote at that time, principle for redistricting of state legislatures and requiring legislative districts to be substantially equal in population. The other U.S. constitutional provision there is the one that the Supreme Court used to require congressional districts to follow the one person, one vote rule. And that was kind of an interesting interpretation based on that sentence quoted there. The House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every 2 years by the people of the several states. And the court concluded that the phrase by the people could only mean that that the principle of one person, one vote would be followed. You can see there's a little different standard set out there for congressional redistricting versus legislative redistricting. The phrase used for the for legislative redistricting there, the 14th Amendment interpretation is substantially equal in population, which gives more leeway than the standard used for congressional districts, which is as equal as practicable, which, as Mr. Watson will describe in more detail, has come to mean that those congressional districts better be as equal as the legislature can make them, or have a good, the legislature better have a good reason for variation. Moving down one level of authority from the U.S. Constitution is the federal statute that is relevant to redistricting. And this is Section 2 of the Federal Voting Rights Act of 1965, which prohibited discrimination on the basis of race in elections, and particularly applied to states and political subdivisions. And somewhat later, the requirement was added also to apply to situations where the same thing is being done to members of language, and that should be minority group instead of majority group there. There's a, I'm not sure if it's a typo or just an error, but anyway, it should read, because he's a member of a language minority group. And this is Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
Excuse me, Mr. Penner.
Yes.
Representative Mariani.
I apologize. It's late and I'm tired. Where are we?
We're on page 2. I'm about halfway down the page there under federal statute. At the end of the description of the federal statute there, where it says, or because he is a member of a language minority group.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
There's another section of the Voting Rights Act that you might hear about. That's Section 5. And Section 5 applies only in states or parts of states where it was determined that there's a history of racial or other discrimination in voting. And those states are subject to special scrutiny by the Justice Department, including a requirement that the Justice Department give prior approval to any change in those states' laws that involve elections. And those states include the states in the Deep South, but also include parts of some northern states. So, for instance, two townships in Michigan are subject to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and a number of counties and townships in New Hampshire, for instance. So it's primarily the southern states, but some other areas as well. But no part of Minnesota is subject to Section 5. Now, moving down to the next level of legal authority, we have the Minnesota Constitution. And there are two provisions in the Minnesota Constitution that are relevant, and they're reproduced here in full on page 2 toward the bottom of the page. Article 4, Section 2 says that the number of House and Senate members shall be prescribed by law. That means the legislature does it by statute. It's not constitutional how many members of the House and Senate there are. And there's a sort of a our own little state one person, one vote concept there, saying that the representation in both houses must be apportioned equally throughout the state in proportion to the population. The next section there, Article 4, Section 3, you can see says that at its first session after each new U.S. Census, the legislature has the power to redistrict the congressional and legislative districts. That phrase, at its first session, means the first two-year session after the census. So it would include 2001 and 2002 as one session. So you have the legislature has the authority in both of those 2 years. And notice the next sentence says, senators shall be chosen by single districts of convenient contiguous territory. There's no analogous provision for the House. What that means is that there's one senator per Senate district, but there's no constitutional requirement like that for the House. So the legislature could, if it wanted to, and it met federal constitutional requirements, could have more than one House member per House district, at least based on the Constitution. Then the next sentence there, I'll just comment on a little bit. No representative districts shall be divided in the formation of a Senate district. And what that means is that the House districts have to be what we call nested within a Senate district. And so there could be, since the legislature can say how many senators and House members there are, it could be one House district nested within each Senate district, or two, or three, or any number. But this is a feature that most other states have. Most other states don't have this nesting requirement, and I think it's probably something that makes redistricting a little more difficult, because the House and Senate districts are interdependent, and I assume that in states that don't have that nesting requirement, it's a little bit easier for the two bodies to kind of go their own way on redistricting. They don't have that same need to have those same operate within those same boundary lines. I'm going to move down. By the way, I didn't say this, but feel free to ask questions any time. Moving down to Minnesota statutes, and keep in mind we're now down to a level of things that the legislature can change and doesn't have to take as a given. We have first the prescription by statute of the number of members of the Senate and House, 67 and 134 at the bottom of page 2 of the handout. In the 1972 redistricting, a federal court redistricted the Minnesota legislature and decided it would be a good idea to have just 35 Senate districts and 105 House districts. So there were three House districts nested inside each Senate district. And I don't know why the court decided that. Maybe it was just easier to have a smaller number of districts. But anyway, that was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court reversed and said, no, you can't. The court has the power to redistrict, but it doesn't have the power to ignore a valid state law that is not itself unconstitutional. So districts that the court was replacing were unconstitutional because they were no longer equal, but the court couldn't go further and just ignore a Minnesota statute. Going on to the next page, page 3, apportionment. The statute we just looked at established the number of House members and the number of senators. This one's a little bit different. It establishes the number of districts, 67 and 134. And here we get in the second sentence here, we get each Senate district is entitled to elect one senator. Remember, that's constitutional. And then the rest of the phrase, and each House district is entitled to elect one representative, that is not constitution. That is not required by the Constitution. So here the legislature by statute decided that there would be one House member per House district. Now, continuing with our discussion of statutes, the next group of statutes here on page 3, 2.742 to 2.812, and the others there in that paragraph, are in Chapter 2 of Minnesota Statutes and describe the current House, the current legislative and congressional districts. And it'd probably be a good idea, I haven't reproduced them here because they're very long, but it would be a good idea, if you haven't already looked at them, to look at them sometime just to see what they look like. Some of the districts are very simple to describe. They're, two counties plus three townships and two cities in another county. Others of the districts are very, very complicated to describe and involve going along the extension of a street and following utility rights of way and creeks and railroad tracks, and you almost get into what lawyers call meets and bounds legal descriptions. So some of them are quite complex and some are simple. But anyway, they get put in Minnesota statutes. And so when the legislature redistricts, one of the things it needs to do is to repeal those current statutes and somehow replace them with a new description of the legislative districts. The next statute I want to talk about is Minnesota Statutes 2.91. That was enacted in 1994, so it was not in existence during the last redistricting. And the rest of these statutes on the list here I have reproduced in the appendix at the back of the handout. And I kind of tried to do a short version and a long version here, but I think we're just going to jump to the appendix now, so that, because I think it's important for us to actually look at the statutes themselves rather than just a brief summary of them. Section 2.91 deals primarily with giving the Secretary of State authority to correct obvious errors in redistricting plans passed by the legislature. And so, for instance, the kind of errors that are described here include having a piece of land that is in no House or Senate district was just left out somehow, or having a piece of land that turns out to be in two House or two Senate districts, in other words, where the description of districts by mistake ended up overlapping, or situations where there's just an obvious error. So when a district is being described and it says go to the intersection of Highway 38 and Highway 36 and turn left, and it's obvious that it was intended was to be turned right, and everything that follows that follows what you would do if you turned right. So anyway, this gives the Secretary of State the power to order corrections where it's clear that that a simple mistake was made, and give some criteria for how to make those corrections. And then in Subdivision 4 requires the Secretary of State and the Reviser of Statutes to recommend to the legislature any additional technical corrections that seem to be desirable. Moving on to the next page, we're now getting into local units of government. And I think this at least was kind of surprising to me to see how many statutes there are that deal with redistricting of local governments. And I think it gives us an idea of how complex this whole process of redistricting from start to finish is, including legislative redistricting and all of the local governmental unit redistricting that follows from it. I'm not going to go through these statutes in great detail, but I wanted to put them in here and at least let you see them and point out a few things about them. The first one is on page 6, dealing with redistricting of election districts, and this includes cities that have wards, that use wards for city council elections, and also other election districts, including county commissioner districts, park and recreation districts, school districts, soil and water conservation districts. And in subdivision 1 there, you can see that a city that elects council members by wards is not allowed to redistrict those wards in a year ending with 0 and or 1. And the idea is they're supposed to wait for the legislature to complete its redistricting, and they're not supposed to make any changes that would mess up the legislature being able to use the census data and the census the boundaries used for census purposes for redistricting. And you can see here it says that once the legislative redistricting is done, the wards must then be redistricted within 60 days after the legislature's been redistricted, or at least 19 weeks before the state primary election in the year ending in 2, whichever comes first. So in other words, if the legislative districts don't get done, there's a kind of a date here where the cities are required to go ahead anyway. So once it's 19 weeks before the state primary election, they're required to simply go ahead and redistrict without knowing what the legislative districts are going to be like. And subdivision two, dealing with local election districts other than cities with wards, require them to wait a little longer, because they're supposed to wait until the municipalities have readjusted the precincts based on the census. So there's a kind of a complicated time frame here for local government redistricting. But in any case, it's the timing of these is all basically the same. We'll see in the rest of these statutes that it's all stated as they have to do it within a certain number of days after the legislature is redistricted, even if that comes early. Even if that comes this May, let's say, they have to get it done within 60 days or 80 days, or there's some other time periods in here after that time. Or if the legislature doesn't get it done in time for the primaries, then the local units have to go ahead. I'm going to move on to the next page now, which deals with election precincts. And this involves municipalities readjusting the election precincts as a result of the census. And I'll direct your attention especially to subdivision 1A, the one headed legislative policy. And I'll just read it. It's the intention of the legislature to complete congressional and legislative redistricting activities in time to permit counties and municipalities to begin the process of establishing precinct boundaries as soon as possible after the adoption of the redistricting plans, but in no case later than 25 weeks before the state primary election in the year ending in 2. And this is where the so-called drop-dead date comes from. If you count back 25 weeks from the state primary election in year 2002, you get that March 19th date that has been referred to as the drop-dead date, or the date by which the legislature has to have a redistricting plan adopted, or the courts will step in and adopt a plan. So this is where that date comes from. Notice there's no other penalty for failing to comply with this. It doesn't say anything bad happens to the legislature if this deadline doesn't get met, but the penalty is that the courts will then have jurisdiction to step in and do the job. I also want to point out about halfway down.
Representative Knobloch has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Paulson. Mr. Pender, can you elaborate on that a little bit? Let's say that the legislature doesn't quite make it and it passes a plan March 24th. Is that plan null and void then, and is it up to the courts to make the decision, or the fact that it's that close and the courts haven't made a decision yet, is it still eligible to be the redistricting plan?
Mr. Pender.
Generally, what goes on here is the courts kind of have to stand ready to have a plan all ready to go on March 19th if the legislature hasn't adopted one. That's kind of the court is kind of gearing up during the process leading to March 19th. I think it would depend. I don't know the answer to that question, and I don't know of any previous case law dealing with that question of what happens if the legislature gets it done not quite on time. I would think the court would have the authority, at least if it wanted to defer to the legislature at that time, but I don't know of any case in which that's come up. So I don't know the answer to that. Don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if there is an answer, a definite answer to that question.
Thank you.
I mean, this is, you know, one way of looking at it is, I mean, this is the source of that drop dead date is this statute right here, which the legislature, of course, could amend.
Mm-hmm.
amend it to read March 24th or whatever date. The other thing I want to point out on this page dealing with these precincts is about halfway down on the page, paragraph C, this is another kind of time frame thing here, that the precinct boundaries have to be established within 60 days of the time the legislature's been redistricted, or at least 19 weeks before the state primary election and a year ending in two. And then there's a sentence there at the bottom, the precincts have to be arranged so that no precinct lies in more than one legislative or congressional district. And that, again, emphasizes, I think, that this stuff is all interrelated, and this is all a complicated group of rules that are designed to fit together within a time frame and specify a logical order within which things get done.
Representative Gray has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You raise an interesting question when you said that this is statutory and can be changed. Is there a federal or a constitutional drop-dead date that we need to be aware of?
Mr. Penn?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gray, no, there's not.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gray.
So at what point would a court intervene if we were to eliminate the statute or elongate the statute into the fall?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gray, we would need to be able to conduct the elections with districts that are constitutional based on the census. So I think at some point, I think the courts would not allow the legislature to set a different drop-dead date if it was one that would interfere with the process of conducting the election. So I think the court would look at the time frame of the general elections and the primary and the filing deadlines for the primary and see if the elections could be conducted within the new date that the legislature provided.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gray.
If we were to attempt to change this date, would citizens have an option of filing in court to restrict our ability to do this on the grounds that it somehow interferes with the election process?
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gray, people could certainly make that claim if they can show by looking at a timeline that changing that date would make the elections impossible to conduct. I think it would partly depend on how creative the legislature wanted to be. I mean, the legislature can change the dates of elections and change filing deadlines and so on too. So I think the key thing there would be the timeline and how that would affect being able to conduct the election.
Mr. Pender, I'm just curious, given that these sort of benchmarks have been laid out in statute, is it likely that the courts would proceed to act in some fashion if the legislature didn't fulfill its obligations, say, by the end of this session, or there were no plans to come to a special session agreement by late summer, early fall? Is it likely that the courts could proceed under that scenario? It could happen, I assume.
Mr. Chair, based on the Emerson versus Groh Supreme Court decision that came out of the last round of redistricting, it's quite clear that the courts are supposed to defer to the legislature and give the legislature a chance to redistrict, and also that the federal courts, in fact, are supposed to defer to the state courts. So the state courts, if the legislature fails or it's clear that the legislature's failed, the state courts have the first shot, and then the federal courts have the next shot. But I think the court has to look at, has the legislature failed, or is it clear that the legislature is going to fail? And I think the court would have to look at all the circumstances to decide how likely it was and how disadvantageous it would be for the court to kind of wait and see.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious. Obviously, putting together a plan would take is something you probably shouldn't do overnight. And so if it seems to me that there's a point at which the court kind of takes a guess at what's happening in the legislature and starts to get itself in gear in terms of doing the kind of work that we're preparing to do here to put together a plan. There's no legal boundaries around that, I suspect. But historically, when do courts begin to do that process? A week ahead, a month, 2 months? And isn't discretion on the part of the court in regards to this matter pretty important?
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, the court has to basically make a judgment of what kind of time frame it needs to be on in order to be geared up and ready to act. So the court has to look at its what resources it has available to it and how fast it can marshal them to get the job done. So it's a matter that the court has discretion over. The court cannot actually issue a plan without giving the legislature a chance to act, but it can certainly be ready, and part of that would be, I think, probably based on what the parties to the case are requesting the court to do.
Representative Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a follow-up then. Has there ever been an appeal of the first courts? I'm not sure what court. But of the initial court's redistricting plan made on the argument that the court precipitated a failed plan by acting hastily and sending signals?
Mr. Pender?
Not that I know of, Representative Mariani, but that doesn't mean hasn't been one somewhere in some state in some year. I'm not aware of a situation like that.
Just an intriguing thought about whether or not the court can trigger a crisis in redistricting by acting hastily.
Please proceed.
I'm going to move along here now. On page 8, there are, starting at the kind of near the bottom of the page there are two statutes dealing with the Secretary of State, and I'm not going to go over those in detail, but they basically involve giving the Secretary of State the authority to interact with local governmental units, to assist them in redistricting, to provide them with computer technology, to train local governmental officials and staff on how to do redistricting. And on page 9, starting in the middle, is a statute dealing with redistricting of cities by wards. And this sets out a kind of a one-person, one-vote standard for cities with wards, and has an interesting little clause there in subdivision 2. This is about 4/5 of the way down page 9 in subdivision 2. If the governing body of the city fails to take either action within the time required, that means either decide the wards are okay, still okay, or decide they need to be redistricted, no further compensation shall be paid to the mayor or council member until the wards of the city are either reconfirmed or redistricted. So I thought that was kind of an interesting incentive for cities to get their redistricting done promptly. I'm going to kind of hurry through the rest of this because I don't want to cut into Mr. Watson's time. I'm going on to page 10. Here we have the school board election districts, and Again, you can see here I've reproduced only the parts of this section that specifically deal with that are relevant to redistricting. So I just have these two subdivisions here that involve redistricting, but there's a requirement that school districts, and this is, of course, where they elect members by election district rather than at large, they have to redistrict based on the census, or it says they can conduct a special census for this purpose. And in Section 6, again, halfway down there, they have a similar provision saying if the school board doesn't do the redistricting or decide that it's not necessary, the school board members won't be paid any further compensation until it gets done. Then the bottom of page 10 is the statute dealing with county commissioners. And again, the county commissioners also have to redistrict. And they have the statute says they can have districts that vary by plus or minus 10% from the average district in the county. And then going on to page 11, there's a little section there on Ramsey County that I'm not going to say anything about unless someone wants me to particularly. And I don't think there's anybody from Ramsey. Well, maybe there is someone from Ramsey County. But anyway, at the bottom of page 11 is a section dealing with the Metropolitan Council, and this continues over onto page 12. Because the Metropolitan Council is not elected, we are not constitutionally required to redistrict the Met Council. However, the legislature has passed a law requiring that they be redistricted after each census based on population, and that the legislature do it. And you can see that there on page 12, about a third of the way down the page in subdivision 3A. It says the legislature shall redraw those boundaries, and that is effective in the year ending in 3. And last time in 1993, the legislature did it last time in 1993. And so when that got done at the end of the session, then those new districts became immediately effective. And again, this is a statute. So if the legislature wants to, it could change this and tell the Met Council to redistrict itself or whatever else the legislature wants to do about it.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What if the legislature came to a deadlock on something like this? Then what happens? Does that go to court? I mean, we're obviously violating a statute we put in place, but I could see some real problems here, urban versus suburb, inner ring, people would want one. I could just see a big quagmire coming up on something like this. And then you have people like myself who, I don't want to say we don't care about the issue, but we don't have vested interest in the issue because we're 160 miles away from the capital and in the metro area, 100 miles away. So what happens should we come to a logjam on this? Does it go to court? The districts obviously wouldn't be an equal population, so would they just stay the same? Would the courts draw the lines? Help me out with that one.
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and Representative Seifert, I would say that, I mean, it's not completely clear, but I would say that since this is a law the legislature has created, if the legislature chose not to do it, I don't see any obvious remedy for it. It's not unconstitutional to not redistrict the Met Council. I guess in that case I'd advise the legislature, if it could, to change this law somehow so that it was, you know, so that it wasn't violating the laws, put it off a year or do something else that would avoid the legislature violating the law. But other than that, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm just going to finish up here quickly. The bottom of page 12 deals with the effect of congressional redistricting on the Court of Appeals. There's some interesting features in there, but I'm just going to skip that for now. And we come now to a lower level of authority than statute. In the last round of redistricting, the legislature chose to adopt concurrent resolutions setting forth standards to be used by the House and Senate in redistricting, and those were valid only for the session on which they were adopted, so they're not in effect now. So if the legislature wanted to have concurrent resolutions like this setting standards, and they're at the end of the handout here on pages 13 through 16, and I'm not going to go into those, but anyway, they're there for you to look at, and this is something the legislature could do if it chose to do so. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Pender. And any other questions for Mr. Pender? Mr. Pender, is there any language anywhere that says that the legislature does not do redistricting, that members per diem will be restricted?
Mr. Chair and Representative Paulson, as you can probably guess, no, there is no such provision. Just the local officials have that kind of provision.
Thank you for your presentation. Next, Mr. Watson. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Watson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here. Mr. Pender has given you the most important state laws that govern your redistricting this time around, and I'm going to talk about the federal law. Everything that I have to say or would want to say is included in my paper on how to draw redistricting plans that will stand up in court. You all have copies of that. I'll be going through that pretty much in order, covering all of the main points, and would encourage you, as you have questions, to go ahead and ask them at the time. I don't mind being interrupted one bit. But the first thing that I want to do by way of introduction is acquaint you with some of the key terms that are involved in redistricting. And the very first thing I want to do is help you to sort out the difference between redistricting and reapportionment. Reapportionment is the process of reassigning seats in a legislative body's among established districts, where the number of members per district changes, but the district's boundaries do not. Redistricting, on the other hand, is the process of redrawing those district boundaries. The number of members per district doesn't change. It's the boundaries that change. We've already gotten from the Census Bureau the numbers of state populations. Those were issued back at the end of this December and showed that whereas some states in the Northeast had lost some congressional seats, the states in the Southwest had gained some congressional seats as the population tended to shift in that direction. The reassignment of seats in the Congress resulted in Minnesota keeping its 8 congressional seats. And that reassignment is the process of reapportionment. It used to be back in the 19th century that Minnesota did a kind of a reapportionment too on a decennial basis, when we more often used multi-member districts, particularly for House districts, and after a census would change the number of representatives in a particular Senate district. We don't do that anymore. Not since 1972 have we had multi-member districts. And so since that time, over the last 30 years, we have confined ourselves to redistricting. Now, reapportionment is not a political process. It's a mathematical one. It's carried out pursuant to a formula. You are perhaps aware of the debates that have occurred over the last many years on how the census will be conducted, the debate over a head count versus statistical adjustments to the numbers. That debate, which has been very partisan, is directed at changing the numbers that will be applied to that formula. Other than that, the reapportionment is not a partisan process. But redistricting is very much partisan, because the people who draw the lines have a great deal of flexibility in deciding where those lines are going to run. When they get into drawing lines that create funny shapes, districts that look like salamanders, we call that gerrymandering. A gerrymandering is a term that has entered the popular lexicon, and is sometimes used to describe any kind of technique whereby a partisan majority attempts to give itself an unfair advantage in the next election. But I don't want to use gerrymandering in that broad sense today. I want to stick to the narrow sense that refers to odd-shaped districts. When drawing odd-shaped districts for the purpose of disadvantaging the minority, there are basically just two techniques. The first of those is called packing, where the plan drafters take the minority party and pack as many of them into a given district as possible, giving them a majority in that district, not of just 51%, but maybe 70, 80, or 90%. Why do they do that? They do that so that those extra votes over a simple majority are not available in neighboring districts to elect a representative there. The second kind of technique, which is usually employed following packing the opposition into as few districts as possible, is called fracturing, that is, breaking the opposition up into as many districts as possible, keeping them less than a majority in each district. If the population in a state were homogeneous, so that the Republicans and Democrats were evenly distributed, there would be a majority party in the state that would win every seat in the legislature, because they'd have their 51 or 53 or 55% majority in every single seat. But the population is not homogeneous in Minnesota any more than it is in any other state. And that's why the plan drafters have to go to the trouble of drawing districts' boundaries in a creative way in order to reduce the strength of the partisan opposition. That's one of the facts of life in redistricting, that the district boundaries are always going to be drawn by whoever is in power, whether it's a majority in a legislative body or even two of the three members of a three-judge federal or state district court panel. They will be tempted to use their majority power to pack and fracture the minority. That's why the courts have developed, and state constitutions have included, a number of restraints against gerrymandering. And I'll be talking about those in the balance of my presentation. The first of them is that the districts be of equal population. How do we know the population? Well, the first thing to do is to use official Census Bureau population counts. We don't have them yet. We have a state total. We'll be getting the breakdown down to the block level sometime in the next couple of months, probably during the month of March. The deadline is April 1. But our task is going to be a little more complicated this year than it has ever been before because of the likelihood, not certainty, but the likelihood that we will be getting two different population counts. Where do they come from? Well, the first one is mandated by a law that Congress passed in 1997 while it was engaged in this battle with the Clinton administration over statistical sampling. That law says that whatever else the Census Bureau does in issuing a population count, it must include a count of the population that is done without resort to any kind of statistical sampling. It must be a raw head count. And as a result of a suit that the House of Representatives initiated and brought up to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1999, the court has said that the head count numbers are the ones that must be used for that congressional reapportionment. And like I said, that's already occurred. The court very much left open the question of whether that head count had to be used for redistricting of congressional and legislative seats. The court has not been precise in its use of the term reapportionment or redistricting, and so it's a little confusing as to what exactly the court said. But it's likely, not certain, that the Census Bureau will issue a count that is adjusted. The decision on that is to be made by the Bureau toward the end of February. They're going to have a meeting of their advisory committee on the census. Those people are going to make a recommendation to the director of the census whether to adjust the census counts or not. It's highly likely, since the members of that panel are known, and it's known that virtually all of them support sampling and an adjustment, that they will recommend an adjustment. The director of the Census Bureau currently is a Clinton appointee and may still be in that position, even though there's been a new Secretary of Commerce appointed. The director of the census is a position that requires Senate confirmation. It remains to be seen whether Secretary Evans will have appointed a new census director at that point. In any event, it is still highly likely that there will be a second count and that it will be adjusted.
Representative Gray has a question. Representative Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the event that we get an adjusted count, is that adjusted down to the census tract level then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gray, yes it is. It's adjusted all the way down to the block level. And the adjustment may involve increasing the population count in some areas where the Bureau has concluded that people were overlooked, and it may involve reducing the population counts in other areas where the Bureau thinks that people were double counted, say counted both at their lake home and counted in the city. The student counted both at a college campus and counted at their home.
Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You just sparked a question. I was kind of flipping through to see if there was something relevant, but since you brought it up, I thought I'd just ask. And that is in a city where we have significant college populations where they are living in dormitories and so forth, like a Mankato with Mankato State or Winona State. Representative Pawlowski isn't here right now, but Southwest State and Marshall. Are those students counted in the census, or are they excluded or counted twice, or do you know how the Census Bureau deals with that? And of course in the U of M area it's a big deal as well.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, I think I can give you both the rule on that and the practical problems associated with it. The rule is that the college students are supposed to be counted at the campus where they are resident. They are not to be counted at their home. But there may be some double counting, and there may be some who are omitted. Let me give you a personal example. When my children, who are both away at college, got their census forms, they noticed that the form says, do not count students who are living away from home at college. And in the case of my daughter's boyfriend, who was living away from home at college at the University of Chicago, his roommate, well, he had the good sense to ask her, and she asked me, and I said, no, no, you count there. My son, on the other hand, who was away at Cornell, his roommate read the form and threw it away. Said, well, we're living away from home at college, and so we must not be counted. So there may be some double counting. There will be some people omitted, but they are supposed to be counted on the college campus. How do we measure the degree of population equality? Knowing that the districts have to be roughly equal, how do we measure that equality? We start with a number called the ideal population, which is simply the total population of the state, in our case, divided by the number of districts. To measure how far away any given district is from that ideal, we have the term called deviation. It may be so many people or such and such a percent of deviation away from the ideal. That'll give you a good measure for one district, but it doesn't give you a measure for the plan as a whole. One measure for the plan as a whole is the average deviation, and that's just taken by the sum of the several different deviations disregarding any plus or minus signs. But the measure that most courts have come to rely on to evaluate an overall plan is called the overall range, and that's simply the difference between the largest and the smallest district. So if one district, the largest district is 10,000 over the ideal population, and the smallest district is 10,000 under the ideal population, the average deviation would be 10,000, and the overall range would be 20,000. And that can be either a number of people or a percent.
Representative Knobloch has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Watson, going back to this issue of the statistical standard versus the headcount standard, could we choose to set up some of the districts based on the actual headcount and some based on a statistical standard? Or would we have to, in doing the redistricting, choose one or the other standard for the entire state?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, when the state's decisions are questioned in court, and they wouldn't necessarily be questioned if all parties agreed on what population count to use, but if there's a disagreement over what count to use, the answer the court is looking for is, what's the most accurate? And the courts have said in many, many cases in the past that the most accurate count is going to be the official census count. But they have also said in a number of cases that states are not prohibited from using some other measure. Those measures have included registered voters. They have included population estimates done by local authorities, particularly late in the decade.
But, Mr. Chair, Mr. Watson, I guess, it sounds like we're going to get more than likely two official counts from the Census Bureau, correct?
That is correct.
And so I guess what you're saying is we could use the actual count in one place and the statistical count in another place if we felt it was defensible in court, but doing that might make it less so. Is that the gist of it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, that is exactly right.
Thank you.
As Mr. Pender alluded in his remarks, there are two different standards for population equality, one for congressional and one for legislative. And the standard for congressional districts, as he said, is strict equality unless necessary to achieve some legitimate state objective. What might those legitimate state objectives be? For example, preserving the boundaries of political subdivisions, that is, not splitting cities and counties. It might include making districts that are compact or composed of contiguous territory, or respecting communities of interest, or even avoiding contests between incumbents and preserving the cores of prior districts. All of those have been mentioned by the court as possible legitimate state objectives. But whatever your objective, you must articulate the objective in advance and then follow it consistently with all of your districts, and you must be able to show that you could not have achieved your objective without sacrificing in any other way and still have gotten population deviation that was lower than you did.
Representative Seifert, have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to think of what the courts might use as a criteria when having, because of the population deviation, having to split counties or cities because there's no choice in order to get the population ideally that you need. And if Mr. Watson, Mr. Chairman, could answer what he thinks in his expertise. I'm just thinking in southwestern Minnesota where we've got several cities that are split between counties. The city of Jasper is split about 75-25 between Rock and Pipestone counties. The city of Granite Falls is split about 3/4, 1/4 between Chippewa and Yellow Medicine counties. Would the court object if trying to keep counties together that those cities would be split in pieces, because if you'd want to keep Rock with Nobles, for example, and put Pipestone somewhere else, would they find objection because a small city was, in Jasper's case, maybe 600, and in Granite Falls' case, about 3,000. Would the court find an objection to taking a city and splitting it because you tried to follow county lines over city lines, or do they have a preference of one over the other?
Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert. That's an excellent question, and it requires a fairly extended answer. First, note that I'm talking about federal law, and the federal constitution doesn't say anything about preserving the boundaries of political subdivisions. So as far as that goes, the courts don't care. The federal courts don't care. In many states, they do have constitutional provisions that require you to avoid splitting counties, and in some states that require you to avoid splitting cities. It may become a requirement of the state plan drafters if you pass a statute that sets that forth as a criterion, or if, as the legislature did 10 years ago, you passed a concurrent resolution that sets that as your own criterion. The federal courts, when drawing their own plans in the face of a legislative deadlock, have adopted that as one of the criteria, typically. So it's not a requirement unless you impose it on yourself. So it's not so much one for the courts to enforce. On the other hand, if you have imposed that requirement, and in this state we did, let me give you some of the rules that at least informally we followed in putting together plans 10 years ago. And that would be that where splitting the city will enable both counties to remain whole, you split the city. Where the county will be split anyway, you keep the city together. I don't know that that was applied in every single case, but that was a general operating rule. Is the county split already? Then go ahead, keep the city together.
Mr. Watson, was that a general operating rule that one House or the Senate did over in terms of drafting the plan, or was that wasn't in the concurrent resolution itself? Or?
Mr. Chairman, it was not in the concurrent resolution itself, no. Okay. It was just an operating procedure.
Representative Seifert.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm thinking of a more obvious example outside of a small municipality like Jasper, and now moving to a city like St. Cloud. And Mr. Knobloch can correct me if I'm wrong. Sherburne, Stearns, and Benton counties are the three splits in the city of St. Cloud. Right under current law, without any kind of joint resolution, that could be split up any which way with part of St. Cloud, and you could have all three counties splitting the city, or each county being split accordingly, and then going toward, in one case, maybe toward the city of Foley, in another case, toward the city of St. Augusta or whatever. Unless we would restrict ourselves by joint resolution, it would make no difference under current law.
Mr. Chairman, Watson, Seifert, that's correct.
Okay.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned kind of a general operating procedure that you used in deciding whether to split cities or have counties split. Are there a list of other general procedures that were used 10 years ago? Are you just speaking off of memory, or you're not going to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Craig, yes, I am speaking from memory. To my knowledge, these are not written down anywhere.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gray.
From memory, can you tell us of any others that come to mind?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gray, yes, I can on this subject. And that is, if you're, let me back up a little bit again and talk about the counting rules. Our software then, as it does now, produces a report of the number of political subdivisions that have been split. And it started out with a number that showed that if the city of Minneapolis, for example, were split into more than one legislative district, that was counted as one split, because the city was split. Split St. Paul, well, then that's two splits. But later on in the process, having had some experience with it, we refined the count so that it would tell you that if Minneapolis was split into 10 house districts, the number of splits was 10. The competition among people for plans, and when you're in an environment where you're presenting your plan to a federal court to be adopted and to a state court to be adopted, you're trying to come up with numbers that look good, have the lowest number of splits. So that meant in a city like Minneapolis and St. Paul to split it as few times as possible. And it came down to meaning that in the case of both of those cities, where it was apparent that the population numbers would require you to go outside the city in order to make the balance of the certain number of districts that would fit in there, you had a choice. Are you going to cross that boundary with all of your districts or with just a few? And the working policy became, we're just going to split it once. We're going to cross the boundary once. It minimizes the number of splits, makes your statistics look better.
Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a follow-up to that, do the courts tend to look more kindly upon single splits rather than multiple splits? I think there's only one split with Minneapolis right now, with Representative Gleason having Richfield and Fort Snelling and part of Minneapolis. If you had a situation where you had several districts, where you had Minneapolis moving into Fridley or Edina, for example, would the courts look less kindly upon that in the case of St. Paul and Representative Wozlik's district, where it goes into part of North St. Paul and Maplewood, where there's one split? Would you think the courts would look unkindly on having Minneapolis and St. Paul going into the entering suburbs in multiple circumstances rather than keeping them contiguous within the city?
Mr. Watson.
Just an opinion. You don't have to give it to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, again, let's place this in context. If the court is looking at the plan to determine whether it's constitutional, that's pretty much irrelevant. It's the legislature that's put on itself the burden of doing that. On the other hand, if there's been a deadlock in the political process and the court is being called upon to adopt a plan of its own, the court is required, as Mr. Pender told you, to first defer to the state's redistricting policies. And if the legislature has adopted a policy, if the legislature and the courts for the last 30 years have followed a policy of trying to minimize these splits, then the court is going to feel constrained somewhat to try to also minimize splits. That's where you get into counting the splits, the numbers game, and where the court will be more inclined to favor a plan that has a lower number of splits.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Watson, 10 years ago, at what point did we pass that resolution? Did we pass that prior to our plan or concurrent with the submission of our plans?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, it was just a little bit before. The resolution had been introduced relatively early in the session. I don't remember exactly when. And it made its way through both bodies. And there was really only one area of controversy, because the LCC Subcommittee on Redistricting had recommended to both bodies a set of resolutions, one for Congress and one for the legislature. The only disagreement that bubbled up in the course of that consideration was the use of the term compact. As Mr. Pender showed you, our Constitution doesn't say anything about districts having to be compact. It says they must be composed of convenient, contiguous territory. And the question was, well, should we add the word compact, or does that cause a variance from our constitutional standard? And the conclusion was, let's add the word compact and say that to the extent it's consistent with the preceding standards, districts must be compact. Well, that process of ironing out that small difference didn't complete conference committee and floor action until May 13th, I believe, was the date. And the plan actually passed the floor within just a few days, May 17th, maybe.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Talking about legislative districts, as Mr. Pender mentioned, the courts will give a legislature an overall range of 10%. That is the difference between the largest and the smallest district. If you live within that range, then you do not have to justify your plan to meet constitutional requirements. In addition, it is possible to have a range that goes beyond 10% if you articulate a rational state policy, such as preserving political subdivisions, making districts compact, and so forth, and show that in order to achieve that policy goal, you had to have districts whose overall range was more than 10%.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Representative Anderson.
Does that mean 10% over and 10% under?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman.
Over and 5% under.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, that means 5% over plus 5% under. When a court is drawing a legislative plan, the courts have tended to not take advantage of that overall range of 10% and do something much more limited. And back in 1972, when we had a federal court draw our legislative plan, they chose for themselves an overall range of 4%, which they expressed as plus or minus 2. The federal court was again called upon to draw the plans in 1982, and they looked at the previous 10 years and said, well, it's plus or minus 2. That's essentially what the legislature did 10 years ago when deciding what range it should use. It did not take advantage of the full 10. It didn't express it as a plus or minus 5. It said, we'll go with what has been good enough in the past and do the plus or minus 2. So we get past the issue of equal population districts. That's pretty objective and relatively simple to accomplish. We then enter the very difficult area of racial and ethnic discrimination and the federal law that governs that. Mr. Pender alluded to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And Section 2 does indeed apply throughout the United States and says that a redistricting plan, no matter what the intent of its drafters, may not have a discriminatory effect. In order for a plaintiff to show that a plan has a discriminatory effect, the plaintiff has to first establish three preconditions. They're called the Jingles preconditions after the case of Thornburg versus Jingles decided in 1986. The first of those is taking a look at the minority population in your state. Is the minority population sufficiently large and geographically compact to form a majority in a single member district? The second question is whether the minority is politically cohesive. That is, do they tend to vote together for the same candidate? Not necessarily for a candidate of the same race or ethnicity, but for the same candidate. The third test is whether the minority's efforts to elect that candidate have been repeatedly frustrated by a white majority that tends to vote as a bloc against the minority's preferred candidate. If you are able, as a plaintiff, to establish those three preconditions, then the court will engage in an examination of what's called the totality of the circumstances and what boils down to, in essence, the history of the jurisdiction in discriminating against that particular racial or language minority. If the court finds a history of discrimination and that a plan would have the effect of denying a minority its fair representation, then the plan drafters have an affirmative obligation to draw districts that the minority has a fair chance to win.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson.
In the last reapportionment plan, they took several Indian reservations and put them in all in one, any Indian reservation and put it in one district, even though that Indian reservation never had a chance of electing a person. Why not allow that to be divided so that you could compact another district in so doing?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Watson. Anderson, another excellent question, because it gets to the law that has governed redistricting plans in this state for the last 30 years. I'm talking about the Voting Rights Act and what the feds mandate, but the federal court that drew plans in 1972 went a step beyond what the Voting Rights Act required. It said that wherever a concentration of a minority population makes it possible, our plan will attempt to increase minority representation. Without looking at the question of whether there's been a history of discrimination, we're going to do it. The federal court in 82 adopted the same standard, and the legislature in 91 did likewise. And it was this effort to increase the likelihood of minority representation that led to trying to keep those areas, even though they may not have had a majority of the voting population, still trying to keep them together wherever possible. And that occurred on the reservations in Greater Minnesota, and it also occurred in Minneapolis and St. Paul. It was a voluntary choice made by the legislature.
It was voluntary.
Yes.
Mr. Watson, go ahead, Representative Anderson.
Do you think that it would be thrown out if it was divided, if the reservation was divided?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, if the numbers are such that there were not enough members of that language minority group to elect a representative, if they were all put together, then splitting them apart is not a violation of the law.
Mr. Watson, was that also a condition that was not in the current concurrent resolution 10 years ago, meeting the requirements you just described that tended to happen in the 70s and then the 80s, and that precedent that was set, was that not written down, but that's sort of done from memory?
Mr. Chairman, no, that was written into the 91 resolution.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Chair, Representative Anderson's question is, could you have a situation where the federal court has a conflicting feeling or opinion about this issue from the legislature and can just simply say, well, you know, we understand the Voting Rights Act, but here's our standard that we've used in this federal jurisdiction, and that's the one we want to apply.
Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, that's essentially what happened with the federal court's decision 10 years ago.
Right. So then, Mr.
Representative Mariani,
if we act in the voluntary manner that we act, the way we acted then, in a different way, and the court still has that opinion, that feeling, then it could override our decision. Is that correct, based on their desires?
Mr. Watson?
For lack of a better word.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, yes, it could do that, and presumably that decision would be appealed, and presumably it would be thrown out on appeal just as it was 10 years ago.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, there are just a couple of things I want to mention about the Voting Rights Act, and Mr. Pender touched on them, that it applies, Section 5 applies only to certain covered jurisdictions, and that if you are a covered jurisdiction, your plan must be pre-cleared either by the Justice Department or by the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. There is a prohibition against drawing a redistricting plan that regresses, that is, that provides for fewer opportunities for minorities to be elected than was the case in the previous plan. But that does not mean that there is any obligation on the part of a state to maximize the number of minority districts, even if you are in a covered jurisdiction. But plan drafters, particularly in the southern states, discovered after they had drawn plans that tended to maximize the number of minority districts, and they did that at the insistence of the Justice Department, was that there was a countervailing force that tended to prevent them from doing that, and that's the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. But the courts have said, and this is all in greater detail in my paper, is that you may consider race in drawing districts, but you must avoid drawing a racial gerrymander. And what is a racial gerrymander? First, you have to beware of bizarre shapes. And I've got some pictures in my paper, and I'll flash them on the screen here, of some districts that were drawn by state legislatures at the insistence of the Justice Department, but then later thrown out either by the lower or the higher federal courts. This is the 12th Congressional District of North Carolina, the I-85 district. This is where Justice O'Connor made her famous statement that reapportionment is one area in which appearances do matter. And I hope you all noticed the thing that's wrong with that statement. What did she mean to say?
Redistricting.
Redistricting is an area in which appearances do matter. And this is not the first nor the last time when the court, I think, used those two words as if they were interchangeable, when for purposes of understanding the issues, it's better to keep them separate. So that's what it looked like. And the court ultimately, in a case involving some Texas districts, said that you must draw districts that are reasonably compact. Here's an example of one the court found not reasonably compact. Any of you who are going to Dallas the end of the week to the NCSL seminar, it'll be held sort of right in the middle of that district. That's the Dallas district. This is what the federal court did to correct that problem and make one that was reasonably compact. Here's another district. This one is over in Houston, and it and the next one are pairs that fit within each other. Not compact, bad. Compact, good. Not compact, bad. Compact, good. This is a Louisiana example, drawn at the insistence of the Justice Department in 1992, thrown out and replaced with this one, which was in turn thrown out and replaced with this one. Florida. This is Gainesville, Ocala, Daytona Beach, Orlando. Bad district. Good district. Here's what they're currently fighting over at the U.S. Supreme Court even now. The state of North Carolina is up there for its fourth time, the third time that they've had full oral argument before the U.S. Supreme Court. And the argument has occurred and will be getting a decision sometime, by June, that will give us the last bit of enlightenment on how to draw our plans this time around before we start, hopefully before we start. This is the fat little district that the legislature put into place for the 1998 election after their 1997 effort had been thrown out by a federal court. But that plan in turn was stayed, put into suspension by an order of the U.S. Supreme Court. And so in the 2000 election, this is the district that was actually used.
Representative Mariani.
I'm just tempted, Mr. Chair. What if you're how do geographical anomalies, geological anomalies play, or do they not? What if you have a desert, you know, or a bunch of swampland, and you've got settlements, you know, ringing it, and then there's nothing? I mean, does that not factor in? I mean, really, is the pictorial kind of thing, or... Because I can look at some of those and say, well, you know, if there's a bunch of swamps surrounding some of that, you know, that looks pretty compact, depending on what's surrounding it. Maybe not that one.
Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, indeed, that's what the courts do look at. They look at, why is the district shaped that way? Give us an explanation.
Okay.
As Justice O'Connor said, bizarre shapes demand an explanation. And in this case, it was, well, I-85 runs along there, and before that, it was the railroad that ran along there. And what happened was that you got settlements of African Americans along the railroad in the various towns from Durham and Raleigh up in the northeast down to Charlotte in the southwest. And that's why the district reaches out to pick up those pockets, because that's where the African Americans are. Well, that's not a good answer, and that's why the court threw the district out. But the court had to go beyond that when it was faced with a district of a little different shape in Georgia. Now, this is not any worse, really, than that Florida district that replaced one. And when the court was faced with it, it said, well, it's not just the bizarre shape that causes the problem. The shape is just a suggestion. It's evidence that there may be a problem. What we're really looking for is an improper motive. If race was the dominant motive, the reason why the boundaries were drawn the way they are, that's bad, and you must avoid that. How do you avoid that? Well, here's the district that took its place. The other one ran from Atlanta all the way down to Savannah. This is really just in the suburban areas around Atlanta, so it was far more compact. How do you avoid the charge that race was your dominant motive? It is by following what the court has called traditional districting principles. And I'll get into those a little bit more in a moment. But remember those Texas districts? The Texas legislature tried to justify their odd shapes by saying that we were not just trying to draw districts based on race. We were trying to draw districts that favored the political party, in some cases Democrats, in some cases Republicans. I forget who was in charge at the time. But they said that we just equated blacks with Democrats, and that's why you see the districts looking like they pick up pockets of blacks here while excluding pockets of blacks there. We were just looking for Democrats. The Supreme Court said, you can't do that. You're using race as a proxy for political affiliation, and that is not proper. So you defend your plan by showing that you followed traditional districting principles. Remember, there are none in the U.S. Constitution. It took the Supreme Court 177 years to find in those words that Mr. Pender showed you that the Constitution requires that congressional districts and legislative districts be equal in population. There's no more in the U.S. Constitution about contiguous territory, although that is in the Constitution of some 27 states. So most of these, really all of these, are state law concerns. Compact, as I said, many state constitutions, about 23 or 21, require districts be compact, and many, I don't have a count, require that they avoid splitting counties and sometimes avoid splitting cities or townships. Constitutions and often resolutions adopted by redistricting committees or by courts who are drawing plans say we will attempt to preserve communities of interest, not break them up. And it is legitimate for the plan drafters to decide to protect incumbents with a couple of standard measures. One is to preserve the cores of prior districts, not move them around too much. And the second is simply to avoid contest between incumbents, avoid incumbent pairs. Our own constitution, as Mr. Pender pointed out, requires that the districts be nested. If the court finds that you have subordinated your traditional districting principles to race, then the plan, even in Minnesota, will be subject to strict scrutiny, where the court will look to determine whether you have articulated a compelling governmental interest for drawing the districts that way, and whether your plan is narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. Now, what are some of the compelling governmental interests that might justify a racial gerrymander? First, remedying past discrimination. Second, avoiding retrogression under Section 5. That doesn't apply here. And third, avoiding a violation of Section 2. That's how this 4th Congressional District in Illinois managed to survive strict scrutiny. After two or three trips to the Supreme Court, not with oral argument, but just with orders, the lower court found and the U.S. Supreme Court summarily affirmed that this district was necessary to achieve the legitimate state objective of avoiding a district that would violate Section 2. This is in the Chicago area, and what you see in this earmuff are two pockets of Hispanic Americans, one north and one south. But they're separated by concentrations of African Americans, both in the middle and to the north and to the south of these districts. So it wasn't possible for the plan drafters to put those two pockets of Hispanics together into the same congressional district without splitting some of the black population away from congressional districts that in the past had been electing blacks. So that's why they took the district way out into the suburbs, went north on a highway, and then brought it back into Chicago. The court said that was okay. Partisan gerrymandering, I really don't have much time to talk about. Am I done at 4:15 or?
Right around there, Mr. Watson.
I'll just make a couple of points. One is that for years and years, the minority party in each state complained that they were victims of unconstitutional partisan gerrymandering. And those complaints were rejected by federal courts, saying, oh, we can't deal with that. It's totally a political issue. It's not justiciable. But in 1986, the Supreme Court in Davis versus Vandiver ruled for the first time that such claims are indeed justiciable. They may be heard by a federal court. But in the several attempts that have been made since then, nobody's been able to prove the existence of a partisan gerrymander because the standard of proof is so high. It's not simply that the minority may be disadvantaged at the polls, it's that they be completely shut out of the redistricting process and shut out of the political process as a whole in that state. Now we get to the final topic, which is federalism in redistricting, that gives me a chance to talk about the Minnesota experience, because we helped to set some important law in this area as a result of our experience during the 1990s. You all know the legislature enacted a legislative redistricting plan because the governor failed to return the bill to the Senate within 3 days after it was presented to him. It became law without his signature. The state court, 3-judge court that had been empaneled to consider challenges to the current legislative and congressional districts, went forward with technical corrections to that hastily passed legislative plan. By the 1st of December, the state court had issued a preliminary order showing what changes it would make. It had a hearing where all the attorneys involved in the case were allowed to comment, see if they had any better suggestions for fixing the constitutional problems with the plan. And as the court was about to issue its final plan, it got enjoined by the three-judge federal court that was entertaining similar claims just down the street, downtown St. Paul. It didn't take long to get that injunction vacated, only about a month, and the U.S. Supreme Court threw out the injunction of the state court's order. So the state court went ahead and later on in January of 1992 issued its final order adopting the corrections to the legislative plan, and it went forward and asked the parties to submit their proposals for congressional plans. The state court had a hearing on those plans on February 17th and announced at the conclusion of the hearing, our final plan will be issued shortly. 2 days later, the federal court issued a new injunction. Now, they learned that they could not enjoin the state court from issuing its order, so they enjoined the Secretary of State from following it. Plaintiffs in the state court then promptly appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and Justice Harry Blackmun, acting as the judge responsible for the Eighth Circuit, issued a stay of the portion of that federal district court's order that had enjoined the Secretary of State from implementing the legislative plan. But presumably, since the state court had not issued a congressional plan at this point, but the federal court had, his stay did not have an impact on the congressional plan, so the election of 1992 went forward based on that legislative plan enacted by the legislature, corrected by the state court, and the congressional plan that had been issued by the federal court in February. But after a full argument and a full opinion written by Justice Scalia for a unanimous court, the Supreme Court reversed that federal district court order, saying that it had gone too far. In fact, it had tripped the state court as the state court was racing to complete a congressional and legislative plan on time within the state's deadlines. So what have we learned from that? As Mr. Pender said, a federal court must defer not only to a state legislature that's involved in redistricting, but also to a state court. We have learned that a federal court may not directly review that state court decision. If there's a decision by a state court, it must be taken to the state's highest court, in this case our Supreme Court, and from there it can be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. But it's not the business of a federal district court to be overruling a state district court. However, there is an opportunity in federal court to challenge what may have been done in a state court by what's called a collateral attack. That is, not an attack by the same parties in the same lawsuit, but an attack by different parties or by the same parties based on a different legal theory in a separate suit in federal court. Even if the federal court does entertain such a plan, such a challenge, and concludes that the plan adopted by a legislature or by a state court violates federal law or the Constitution, the federal court must still defer to state remedies. And that, first of all, means ordinarily allowing the legislature or the state court a second crack at the plan. The federal court lays down the law, says what you've got to do to comply with it, and then gives the plan drafters at the state level an opportunity to draft a new plan. If there's not time for that, then at least the federal court must defer to the state's policies, as Mr. Pender mentioned, that if we have policies that say that we're not going to split political subdivisions and we're going to respect communities of interest, etc., then the federal court has some obligation to defer to the articulated state policies. Another interesting thing that we learned is that when the legislature's work is before a federal court in litigation, the Attorney General has authority to represent the entire state. He's not just speaking for himself, but may speak on behalf of the legislative branch as well. So you may get an Attorney General who is involved in settlement negotiations who agrees to a plan that maybe the legislative leaders didn't really like. But they're not in court. It's the Attorney General in court. So we've all learned we want to be on good terms with our Attorney General over the next couple of years.
Representative Seifert has a question on that point.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to ask, what do we do if we don't want the Attorney General to be involved in this?
Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, the short and flippant answer is amend the Constitution. Because the Attorney General does have that responsibility under the Constitution. The Supreme Court has recognized that responsibility, and I think unless we were to amend the Constitution and change the role of the Attorney General, he's going to be there. I think I've come to the end of my talk.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. Any other questions at all? Mr. Watson, I'm curious, what happens if we don't pass any standards or principles in a concurrent resolution or otherwise, the House doesn't with the Senate, and is it necessary? And what happened in the 80s, was that discussed? I know there was no solution to redistricting in the 80s, but maybe you can comment on that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you don't pass any principles that you intend to follow, and you don't pass a plan, then you are certainly leaving things entirely up to the courts to decide how they want to draw a plan. If you do pass a plan and want to defend it in court, and you've got deviations from strict equality in a congressional plan or more than 10% in a legislative plan, then you're going to have some splaining to do.
So the legislature could still adopt a plan, redistricting plan, without having followed any agreed upon principles, but just having agreed upon a new redistricting plan, get it signed into law and be subject to lawsuits apparently, but that could happen. That's possible.
Mr. Chairman, that is possible.
Okay. Representative Knobloch?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Watson, let's say that the House and the Senate each pass a plan, but they can't get together in conference, and let's say that they are in general agreement on the boundaries in northern Minnesota, but in disagreement on the rest of the state. Will the court typically take the work in which they were agreement upon and just agree with that and then try to settle out where there were disagreements, or are they apt to just do it all themselves?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, to quote from Winnie the Pooh, you never can tell. As he said about bees, you never can tell with bees. And you can't tell with courts, because it may be a different panel of judges this decade from what it was in the last decade. And judges tend to have quite different attitudes toward the whole redistricting process. Some do not want to get near it at all and will decide, a majority of the panel will say, we are not going to draw our own plan. We will take the last best offer. We'll choose one plan or another that's offered by the parties. Other courts seem to like it. They really want to get into it. And they will use any excuse under the sun to draw their own plan. So depending on the personalities that you happen to draw on the bench, they could decide that they will look at what the legislature has done and try to follow it as closely as possible, or they could ignore it completely. The policies that I'm talking about are ones that are articulated in something like a constitution or a statute or a resolution, not something that you can just divine out of a particular plan that might have passed one body or another. A court could use that as an excuse if it liked what you did, to say, well, we're going to adopt this one because that was in the House plan. But they don't have to.
Mr. Watson, you had mentioned earlier the idea that as March 19th drew near, courts would perhaps be working on a plan that might be assuming that the legislature would not come up with one. When do we typically know who the judges would be if we don't come up with a plan? Do we know it on March 19th, or do we know it at some point ahead of time?
Mr. Watts.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, we're likely to know that a long time ahead of that. 10 years ago, we knew the three-judge panel sometime that may have been in March, because under the federal statute, the three-judge panel is convened almost immediately as soon as the complaint is filed that relates to either legislative or congressional redistricting.
Okay.
With the state court, getting the panel appointed did not occur until June 4th, and the suit had been filed back in January, so it took a little longer time. But part of that, I assume, was because of the need to work out what procedure they were going to use. Now, as I think you all know, we've got two suits already in state court challenging the current legislative and congressional plans, and we don't really know who is going to hear those yet, but I would expect that maybe by early summer we'll know, and certainly I would expect we will know long before March of next year.
Thank you.
Mr. Watson, can I just follow up with one more question in terms of the principles? So it is certainly possible that the legislature can fulfill all the requirements from the Constitution, federal and state, the Federal Voting Rights Act, pass a plan, get it signed by the governor, without ever having adopted any principles through concurrent resolution.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And in many states, particularly 10 years ago, there was a fierce debate over whether it was in the interest of legislative committees to adopt principles or not. Because you can be hung by your own petard. If you articulate principles and then don't follow them, you can be hurt badly in court. But I think the majority of states found that it was in their interest to adopt principles, and most of them did.
Yeah, Representative,
it's a little risky if you don't intend to follow through.
Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chair, I think this is a joint question from Representative Gray and I, and that was, I'm assuming the answer is not Representative Krenke, but who has filed a lawsuit in the redistricting cases already, even though we don't have a redistricting plan?
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, the first complaint was filed on January 4th by one Susan Zachman and a group of other plaintiffs, and on the bottom of the complaint it shows that the complaint was in the directory of the RPM, and it's the Republican Party of Minnesota. So it's a group of Republican plaintiffs who filed the suit, and the two attorneys were one Charles Schreffler and Tom Heffelfinger. The second suit was a motion to reopen the suit of 10 years ago, and that was filed by Alan Weinblatt, who is an attorney who has represented the Democratic Party in the past, and the lead name plaintiff in that case is Patricia Kotlow. The first complaint was filed in district court in Wright County and will be assigned to a single judge. I don't know who the judge is yet. And the motion was to bring the old case back to life before the same three judges who had done it 10 years ago, and that would be Judge Harriet Lansing of the Court of Appeals and Judge William Walker of the District Court in the Detroit Lakes area, and Judge Kenneth Moss of the District Court in the Stillwater area.
And Representative Seifert, I believe 10 years ago, I think some Democrats filed first at that point, so I'm sure we have not seen the end of any suits filed going forward this cycle as well. So. Well, thank you, Mr. Watson. If there's no more questions, we appreciate your testimony very much. We know you have a good historical background and an expert in this area, and encourage members to seek you out privately as well.
Thank
With
you,
that,
Mr. Chairman, it's been a pleasure.
Members will meet 1 week from today. Thanks again.
Are you alleging that the pending plant or the would be is wrong? Or?
Yeah, how can
that's interesting.
Allegations about a plan that doesn't exist.
Is that the name?